From KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Hannah Rosen's latest book tracks this shift going on in the culture. Women finally getting the upper hand in most all facets of life, school and work, even relationships. And if she's right, it's a big deal. As she puts it, it's the end of 200,000 years of human history. The book has gotten a lot of attention because of the title, The End of Men, which she admits is a little obnoxious, but she says it makes her case. Men, she says, are not adapting to a modern economy that's looking for different skills. Yes, she says, there are still inequities. But she points out that if you just look at the sheer velocity of the forces at work, they're really the last artifacts of a vanishing age. Today in the program, Hannah Rosen will join us to talk about this new era, the rise of women. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. 2009 was the tipping point. For the first time in history, the balance of the American workforce landed in the favor of women. And it makes sense if you look at the statistics in Hannah Rosen's new book. For every two men who will receive a BA this year, three women will do the same. Of the 15 job categories projected to grow the most in this country in the next decade, 12 are dominated by women. And it's not just there. Women, Rosen says, dominate colleges and professional schools in every continent except Africa. She says once she started exploring all of this, she found evidence of it everywhere. Centuries of habit and history, she says, made it hard to see at first, but she's found a clear pattern. Men who have been displaced by an economic shift that's been in the works for some three decades now. Her book gets a lot of attention for its name, The End of Men, but you should also pay attention to the subtitle, The Rise of Women. Hannah Rosen is a senior editor at The Atlantic and a founder of Double X, Slate's women's section. She also wrote a book called God's Harvard about Patrick Henry College, a Christian college in Virginia. She's joining us today from the offices of Slate in Washington, D.C. And Hannah Rosen, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I wanted to jump right into the story you tell very early in the book because it kind of gets us going on the concept or how you came up with it anyway. It's a story you tell happened a few years ago. You're at this beach town in Virginia where you and your family go every year. And you say you started to notice that you almost never saw any men.
Yes, it's somewhat apocryphal. I mean, I'd been going there for many years and used to seeing men kind of driving around in pickup trucks, doing work around town with their families at the fair or at church. And it just seemed to me that as time went on, I saw fewer and fewer men. There is actually a novel in which the men disappear from a small Virginia town. It wasn't quite that drastic, but, you know, they hadn't all gone to Mars. But it felt like something had happened. And then I got to know this couple in the town, basically, who got me thinking even more about what had changed.
Well, a woman, her name is Bethany, and you really wanted to talk to Bethany's daughter's father, Calvin, because you talk about when you were talking to Calvin, I'm wondering what you were thinking about, because it seems like it wasn't a book then when you were talking to him. You were just kind of interested in the idea in some way.
Well, I was actually – I had been reading Susan Faludi's book, Stiffed, which was about how men had suffered in this recession. And in my mind, I was mulling – about how to write a Where Are They Now piece, kind of what has happened to these men? We're in yet another series of recessions. Is there some way I can chronicle what's happened to American manhood? So it certainly was on my mind as a journalist to write about these kinds of things. So I got to know this guy, Calvin, and as a nosy journalist, I began to play the, you know, can this marriage be saved role with this couple? You know, right. Can Calvin go back to his house? Can I help him get a job? You know, it's just the way you form relationships with people when you're doing reporting.
And I guess the question that you really came up with is that, I mean, this is how you put it in the book, that there was no way back. You say that those lives that these men have lived before, I mean, they were no longer there for them to get back to, I guess.
Yes, that was my light bulb moment, that I was trying to patch together an old order that basically didn't exist anymore, that this woman, Bethany, was effectively the head of her household, that Calvin felt largely excluded from this economy. Bethany was, like many women in her position, raising her child, going to school. She was, in this case, studying to be a nurse. She was working during the day, going to school at night. And So the idea that I could just, you know, stitch them back together and he would be the head of the household and go back home, and then she would take on the wifely role, it suddenly occurred to me that that wasn't going to happen, mm-hmm. that something profound had shifted in not just the economy, but the society, the relationships between men and women, how we think about marriage, how she was raising her daughter, and that it had changed in some sense in a permanent way. And so that's when I began to realize I was asking the wrong questions. And because I was running this women's site, it was 2009 and all these numbers were coming at me, you know, just as part of blogging culture, you kind of follow, track the news pretty closely. So it's like this human story on one end that I was looking to do a feature story about and these numbers coming at me, some of which you read at the top of the hour about women suddenly becoming the majority of the workforce. Yeah. You know, a year later, it was the majority of PhDs. And I was just starting to put the pieces of the puzzle together.
When did it occur to you that this was a story about women as much as men?
It was this Bethany revelation. Yeah. It was suddenly I thought of, you know, there was also a study that came out about breadwinner wives around that time, you know, about the increasing number of women who are the head of their family, breadwinners. I shouldn't say the head of their family because that gets determined in all sorts of ways that are sometimes have nothing to do with money, but who were the breadwinners in their families. And so so that's when it occurred to me that there was seismic underlying shifts that could permanently change the way we view each other and the way we live now. So yeah, it was around 2000, sort of the end of 2009, I would say.
Yeah. You didn't choose the title for the first piece you had written called The End of Men. It was for The Atlantic. It was an editor who chose it. And I guess it's fair to say you still feel kind of conflicted about it, even though you did give it the name of your book.
Yes, that is absolutely fair. I mean, as writers, we write their stories. I don't actually even see the headlines until they're on the newsstands. And it had, not only was the title so bold, but it had this, you know, fairly insulting kind of graphic that went along with it, which many men would find emasculating. And I thought, wow, okay, here we go. And so that title, you know, then when I started to write a book, I actually wondered whether I should keep the title, because a more accurate title would be something like, you know, The End of Male Privilege or The End of Male Dominance or The End of One Kind of Man. But the way our culture works, that is a very memorable phrase, the end of men. It became attached to my argument over the last 2 years. And it's a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing because it gets a lot of attention. It's a curse because it immediately turns a lot of people off and also makes the book, which is full of stories and reporting, feel vastly more bombastic than it actually is. And also because my son, like, really hates the title. So that's, that's the third way in which it's a curse. But.
Well, you mentioned that you're not exactly comfortable being the voice of feminism, that you've been called a radical feminist, you say, and you've been called an anti-feminist.
Yes, I have been called both of those, and nobody believes me when I say this, but I'm not actually that ideological a person. I don't really fall into camp. So, yes, I have been attacked from both sides, from men for obvious reasons, because it's insulting to have a woman diagnose you as, as a sort of the loser of this current economic situation.
Right.
How could that not be insulting? And from feminists, because I think this reading is not comfortable. I mean, this idea that women are moving into ascendance, I think, violates not just our kind of political norms, but also a lot of women's feelings about their experiences in this economy. So it's political as well as emotional, the sort of women's response to this argument.
Mm. You write about that once you started looking around, that you started to see evidence of this everywhere. And I mentioned this in the introduction. I kind of wanted to ask you about it. You say, it was only centuries of habit and history that prevented everyone from seeing it. What do you mean by that exactly?
So I think we're just used to understanding the economy and male dominance in a certain way. You know, we have this evolutionary story effectively that we tell ourselves about testosterone and aggression, and that means that men will always be dominant and that women will always be taking care of children. And I think it's very hard to get away from that narrative. You know, and also I do live on this planet. In fact, I live in Washington, D.C. Like, I see that, a lot of the actual, real power in corporations and in Congress is held by men. So we tend to focus on that tippy top as a kind of symbol of what's happening. But actually, these underlying shifts are quite profound in the ways that women are adapting themselves to the new economy in ways that men are not, in the ways that our notions of what makes a good leader are changing, and the way that, for example, women are converging. I have a chapter on violence, which really throws people off. But I put that in there on purpose because I wanted to show that, you know, aggression, these are traits that we have considered traditionally masculine and feminine, but they do not belong to men or women. You know, that women are increasingly taking on what we have traditionally considered masculine traits over the years, with some penalty. I mean, they're paying a penalty in the culture, but they are doing it. And, you know, men much more slowly are taking on feminine traits.
I want to come back to that because I'm guessing you're getting a little bit of pushback from people who, and you know, there's such a lot of conversations about how different a male brain is from a female brain. And you don't buy it entirely. I mean, you think that, how did you put it in the book, that these are kind of stories that we tell ourselves to make sense of all this?
Yeah, I mean, I part on that question, I think I partly don't buy it because there isn't quite, we're so new and rudimentary in how we understand the brain. And it seems to me that the obvious answer is going to be that we are made up by how our brains are plastic and constantly responding to the environment. Like, it seems to me that can only be it, that we start out with some fixed stuff, and then that fixed stuff kind of interacts with our changing environment in some way. And that seems to me like, you know, that's going to be where we land. So I think, you know, I have two sons and a daughter. They're all elementary age. I have a son who only plays with cars and trucks, only. I have another son who is a budding computer program, and I have a girl who reads all the time. So it's not that I don't understand that, you know, it's some rudimentary level, like, you know, we pop out differently. But I don't like to say, you know, therefore my, you know, therefore that will determine college, marriage, all these very complicated decisions we make over the course of a lifetime.
Well, it did make me wonder, you know, about how evolution plays out, that these environmental factors, if you strip out, for example, which, and you write about this in a chapter in the book, if you strip out this idea of size and strength being one of the big advantages that males have, then things change. Things become decidedly different.
Yes, and so many things change, you know. You know, this, my economic story begins with the manufacturing era, which is a fairly familiar story. So in the book, I profile a town as an example of what happens when a central manufacturer, which employs many of the adults in the town, leaves. And what you can see is it really, you know, and manufacturing towns, and I think we see this more and more in the political dialogue and, you know, in the twin conventions that we recently have, manufacturing has come to stand for American manhood. Like when politicians talk about manufacturing, they're talking about what's happening to the American man. And so, you know, when that leaves, it's not just people's economic futures which get called into question and have to be reevaluated. It's so much more. I mean, it's, you know, how is the man in this Christian town remain the head of the household if he is no longer making the most money? I'm not saying he doesn't remain the head of the household. I'm just saying you have to rethink these questions. You know, in the next generation, you see in my chapter that going down the generations, then something quite different happens where you feel like the men are, you know, genuinely lost, and the women are more like the woman we mentioned in my introduction, where they seem to suddenly be doing everything just because they have the children, so they have to deal with the children. So I don't think this is the place we land necessarily. I do feel like an earthquake has hit us. You know, the pieces are everywhere and they haven't all fallen back into place yet. Yeah. But I do think the earthquake has hit us.
Well, you're talking about, this is Alexander City, Alabama, where you go.
Yes.
Home of, it's the Russell Corporation. They make athletic clothing. And it's, you go there in the wake of this economic disaster where these thousands of people in the company had been laid off. And there's this new domestic reality, as you put it. And the basic idea is you're talking about the kind of this, what you describe as the moderately educated middle, which is slowly turning into this matriarchy. And what I found interesting was the question that you raised, what are the implications, you know, the consequences of women now having this domestic power. It's changed. It's not a feminist nirvana, you say, but certainly things are changing. I mean, how are things changing in that way?
Yes, it is not a feminist nirvana. I want to start there because I think that often this book is also misread as triumphalist.
Yeah.
Like, this is awesome. We have a matriarchy. You know, may the men go to the moon. You can see from the stories that it's actually heartbreaking in many ways. It's not natural. It's not where we want to land, you know? So what does happen is that the men are a little shell-shocked by what's happened to this industry that they've not only worked at, but they have so thoroughly identified with that it has come to define for them what it means to be a man and a father and a provider. That's all kind of interwoven with their identity as, you know, factory managers or factory men. And so they are having a hard time adjusting. They have pretty rigid notions, or rigid is sort of judgmental, but they have very fixed notions, I will say, of what jobs are manly and what jobs are not manly.
Right.
And it in a lot of these small towns, really the only jobs increasingly that are available once the industries leave are government jobs, teaching jobs, and jobs at hospitals. But they think of those jobs as not manly enough. And so they're a little lost about what to do with themselves, where the women really are starting from the bottom. They're not feminists, the women that I write about, not at all. They are, you know, this is new to them to be working and having a steady paycheck, or it's new to them to have the only steady paycheck in the family or the most reliable steady paycheck. And it's uncomfortable for them. It's not how they have been biblically raised to, you know, structure a family. Nonetheless, there is some empowerment and exhilaration and power even in being in that situation, whether you acknowledge it or fully embrace it or not.
Mm. I want to ask about there's a chapter you write that talks about, sort of gets at this question of how it is that women essentially remade the economy. And you go to the University of Wisconsin, the pharmacy school there in Madison, because you say you wanted to get a glimpse of this new generation of hungry female professionals and what they're like. Talk about what you found there.
Yes. So I chose pharmacy because pharmacy is one of those professions that reminded me of what secretarial school was like in the 20s. It's just, you know, it's the place where women who say are the first ones in their family to go to college, to get a leg up and, you know, to enter the middle class. It's a six-figure profession. It's relatively high paying. You know, it's relatively robust as a profession. And so I wanted to go there because pharmacy is also one of the professions that's being dominated by women. It used to be predominantly male. Now pharmacy schools are in the sort of 60-62% female. And so the next generation of pharmacists are going to be women. And so what I find is, well, initially, just in terms of the economics of pharmacy, it suddenly makes sense why women enter pharmacy and why pharmacy has become feminized. Mm. It's because it used to be that as a pharmacist, you were this entrepreneur, you had to be there all night, you know, not to mention the even earlier days where you would be lifting heavy sacks of one ingredient or another to mix your pills. Pharmacy had a certain mystique. You know, over time, a pharmacist was almost like a magician. Over time, pharmacy has become part of the global economy, and you know, so now you go to Walmart or Walgreens and a pharmacist is sort of an hourly person. It becomes more manageable for women effectively. They don't have to be in the shop all night. They don't have to make house calls. You know, they're working hourly wages, you know, in a normal sort of fixed way. And so I'm trying to describe kind of why a profession becomes friendly to women and how the entry of women, which once used to be a detriment to a profession, used to show that a profession was devalued, is now a sign of success for a profession.
So the older models, the kind of top-down models, that's changing. And you write about how, you know, some of these traditional, I got to be careful here, traditionally feminine attributes, you know, empathy and patience and problem solving, that kind of thing has started to sort of overtake the ideas, the older models, I guess.
Yes. And this is a shifting target. I mean, that's what I think is a little confusing about my book. So these are things that we think of as traditionally feminine, and they are serving women well right now, partly because the healthcare professions are growing, partly because of this thing I called the traveling sisterhood of the economy, which means that as, you know, as more women enter the top, like become lawyers and doctors, they open up jobs for women at the bottom to do things, to do women's work that women used to do for free. You know, childcare, elder care, food preparation, all the kinds of stuff that a wife would do is now paid work. And so you have these, you know, women entering at different parts. And yes, it is ironically taking advantage of old, you know, notions of who's feminine and who's masculine. Like in my ideal world, and in fact, this is what happens to Calvin, the character in my introduction, who we introduced at the beginning of the hour. He does decide to become a nurse at the end, which drives some men crazy because then they think my only message here is that all men have to become women and then it will all be OK. But in fact, you know, right now, women are able to take advantage of this traditionally feminine notions of which job is for whom.
You've said that for the stories that you've told, you've kind of copped to this a little bit, that there are some stereotypes that emerge. And I wanted to get you to respond. One of the men you profile in the book, a guy named Andy, has written this kind of response. He said this. He said that you had rendered him as a hapless stock character in what he described as your tableau of post-masculine despair. And I wanted to get you to respond to that because I don't get a sense that you're saying men are despairing, but you do identify certain trends and they maybe come across as stereotypes. But I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that.
Sure. I actually think Andy is making a fair criticism in one sense. You know, books are imperfect and you don't realize the full extent of them until after they're out there in the world. And I would say that I didn't quite realize that I was echoing sort of man after man that I profiled would so strongly strike people as, you know, losers in some way, like, or yeah, struggling in other ways. Like I have, you know, for example, I profile Andy and I talked to each other, and originally I had chapters, a chapter that included full interviews with people who answered my breadwinner wife survey. So people who were in relationships where the wife made more than the husband. I interviewed dozens of such people and originally reprinted the full interviews as a separate chapter, but my editor and I decided it was slightly out of place. That's where Andy's full interview was printed. Yeah. So it's true. He is now reduced to two sentences, the poor guy. So you do not get the full view of Andy's life and relationship. But I did include another stay-at-home father, the father who I include in Pittsburgh, Steve, yeah, who I intended to be a positive role model of a new marriage, but who many people have received as not a positive role, yeah, model. Again, didn't see that one coming. So you know, you don't always get these things perfectly.
I guess, and this is the question I want to get to when we get back from a break. You know, how are men? Clearly, they are, but how are men feeling conflicted about this role reversal? And Hannah Rosen is with us. Her book is called "The End of Men and the Rise of Women." We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West at KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you look at the statistics, you'll see we men are falling behind women at work, at school, even at home. The journalist Hannah Rosen says women aren't just gaining on men. They've pulled ahead. Today in the program, she's joining us to explain the striking transition in the economy and the culture as well. Her book is called "The End of Men and the Rise of Women." Let's take a call. Rick has been waiting. He's in Salt Lake City. Rick, welcome.
Thanks, Doug.
Sure.
Appreciate being part of the conversation. I wanted to call in. My listening to the program today is very interesting to me because my situation with my family is very similar, where my wife and I, we both work and have careers, and when we got married in 2006, we essentially had the same income. And when the economy went downhill in 2008, I'm an author and photographer, I have my own business, we were faced with, you know, me making less and her needing to make more. And so she, you know, went out in the job market and found a job making basically essentially what we both made together. And it's been, you know, difficult at times, but it's actually been a really great experience for me because I've been able to do something, you know, my father was never able to do. He was essentially gone, you know, the whole time working. And I've been able to be home with the kids, which is great.
Yeah.
In my view, and like I said, it hasn't necessarily been easy because I think women and men have different natural skill sets, but it's been rewarding because it has been something we've had to work at.
Anna Rosa, talk about that, because, I mean, I guess the question, again, this really goes to the question I was asking earlier. How are men feeling about this role reversal? I mean, you say in the book, we were talking about Andy earlier, you talk about how he was wistful about his old life, not in existential despair, but wistful about, you know, the role that he had played before. What are you finding? Is Rick typical in some way?
I think Rick is increasingly typical. I mean, Andy would say that, you know, wistful was one thing he felt. You know, it's like all of us. I mean, how does any of us feel about our current situation? I mean, some of us are just, you know, annoyed and rageful. But I think many of us, especially if a situation is new, have some conflicted feelings. So because this is a period of transition, I think most people probably have some conflicted feelings. I mean, I did hear from people who said, you know, what are you talking about? This is no problem. I'm just totally rewarded by that. And then I often would look at the, you know, look at the dateline for those letters, and they would come from Portland, you know, or someplace where like, right. You know, someplace where people are like really more progressive and actually would embrace somebody about these things. But, you know, that's my Rick, the caller is that's my ideal. I mean, what I hope for, what I always say I hope for, say, my two sons, is that if they find themselves in Rick's situation, meaning that, you know, for one reason or another, they want to or end up working 4 days a week or picking up their kids, it shouldn't even be a topic for a radio program. Yeah. It should be, by the time my sons grow up, like totally fine and normal and nobody even thinks about it. And that would be great. I mean, that's the best positive outcome of the trends that I'm describing. You know, the end of men, the beginning of a new kind of man. That's great.
Yeah. Of course, it's complicated. I mean, you say that men are adapting to these models. You talk about, you know, Rick and the men of Portland aside. I mean, you talk about, you know, men are decreasing their average work hours, for example. They are increasing their childcare hours. But you say only at the tiny fraction are moving into Rick's role, you know, that role of the stay-at-home dad.
Right. I mean, that's one of the trends that I pull out in the book. I call it, possibly insultingly, cardboard man and plastic woman. And it's like that doesn't refer to sort of an individual's personality characteristics. What it refers to is a trend I see over the century where women seem to morph and change and take on new roles, I think partly because they're marginalized. I mean, that is what the marginalized do. They adapt. And men, you know, are a little more rigid and unyielding about what it is that they are willing to do. And it's not just men. I think a lot of this is what we women put on men or what society puts on men. We are less forgiving of men who step out of traditional manly roles, whereas we have been very generous towards women to a point, but we've been relatively generous towards women who step out of the traditional. I mean, women didn't wear pants, for God's sake, not all that long ago. So things have changed.
The images in popular culture are interesting, too. I mean, you write about how men are being reflected in popular culture these days. The Omega male is, your colleague Jessica Gross called it. You know, there's the Judd Apatow, the anti-heroes that he kind of portrays, the couch potato, the guys that are really trying to figure out what it means to be a man. What are you seeing in popular culture?
I actually think we're moving slightly away from the Judd Apatow and working out something slightly different already this year. So Judd Apatow presented us with this conflicted moment, you know, this moment in which the men in his movies were lovable. But they had to be dragged along by women who were, you know, shrill, but organized and had their act together, you know, and that was the thing that was being worked out. Whereas now I think we're just starting to see images of men who are domesticated and not emasculated, you know, domesticated and still attractive and sexy to their wives. So Up All Night is one. There's a new NBC show called Guys and a Baby or something.
Yeah,
I forgot.
I don't remember.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, and What to Expect When You're Expecting. I mean, I think we're getting our heads around the idea of, you know, man at home, man not an idiot, which is what's been true in sitcoms for nearly 50 years. It's like man at home is like Homer Simpson, bungling, idiotic, messes everything up. You know, just as we're getting our heads around images of women that are more straightforwardly aggressive.
Back to the phones. Charlie is with us in Park City, Utah. Charlie, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. Welcome.
I'm in sales. I'm also a dad and a husband. And I was curious if you could just speak to how women in middle management has kind of affected how office politics works. My experience has been that's not always a positive change just because of the way men and women interact with each other.
Does that make sense, Hannah Rosen?
Yeah, that's a fair. I mean, I don't know the research on this. It's a little slippery, but it is true culturally and historically that men have always felt the office to be slightly alien to them. If you remember the movie Office Space, you know, there's a way in which like the feminization, suburbanization of work has always felt unmanly to men. I mean, that's like a century old story, or not quite a century, but an 80-year-old story in America. And so there is that. And in terms of how women are as managers, I think this has been studied. Another reason I included a chapter on violence is because I resist this idea that when women enter power, they are very nice and everything is peaceful and harmonious. I think that there is evidence that shows that at this point, women make decisions differently than men, that they tend to take more views into account. They tend to look at the long term. But that doesn't translate into nice, you know. So you know, I don't know. And it may be that one thing the caller is referring to is that, you know, all male or all female environments are more collegial and easier to deal with. That in this moment of discomfort, like in the same way that we puzzled at a different moment in the century about could a man mentor a woman, you know, how much before sexual harassment laws, that was something that, you know, wasn't quite worked out. If you talk to women who were in corporations in the 60s and 70s, they'll describe sexual harassment as completely routine, you know. And I think maybe there's another version of that story now, which is, you know, when these gender relations are still sort of awkwardly being worked out, surely if you have lots of men working for lots of women, there's things that we haven't ironed out yet.
Yeah, back to your chapter about violence with women. You say in the book, you write, there is no natural order, only the way things are. Women can be aggressive, they can be violent. And it's just, I guess that's just the reality.
Yeah, I think what the research I found compelling on this question shows that, you know, we'll never be able to answer the question about whether, you know, who's inherently more violent, right? It seems as if men are, you know, certainly women don't do certain things like murder strangers. You know, men are physically stronger. So testosterone plays a part in all this. Yet, I think we have a long way to go because the compelling research shows that women suppress a lot of their aggressive instincts, that when women are anonymous, they behave as aggressively as men in some lab situations. And when they're not anonymous, you know, then they suppress themselves. And so surely there is more aggression to be expressed on the part of women than there was before. Now, do I think this is good? No, of course I don't think it's good that lots more juvenile females are being arrested. That's terrible. On the other hand, I point it out because I want us to not be so completely attached to our idea that, you know, men are strong, men dominate, men have testosterone, men rule the world. I think that's kind of a subconscious story we all have in our heads.
Were you surprised at how quickly this even so-called natural order has been overturned? I mean, you write about the deep history of patriarchy, you know, centuries. We're talking even thousands of years. And all of that sort of is switching in the matter of a couple of decades. Did that surprise you, kind of the how quickly that all seemed to turn? Or maybe it just seemed that way?
One thing this really came home to me actually when I went to Korea, which is where one of my chapters is based, because there's a version of this all over the world, but it's filtered through different cultures. And Korea is extremely patriarchal, remains extremely patriarchal, yet because of their desire to industrialize, women have advanced. I mean, they've gone through like 100 years of feminist history in 20 years or something. And, you know, you can see like the society kind of rubbing up against itself and the culture kind of not yielding or really yielding in some parts. And so you can see the real fissures and upheavals and tensions, you know, in the society that's kind of feels like it's reached a breaking point. And, you know, the laws that had been in place for, you know, hundreds of years in Korea, you know, suddenly make no sense, like laws about, you know, patriarchal family structure. And, you know, even the statistics on whether people now want boys more than girls or girls more than boys, which have totally reversed themselves. So it's like, you know, you could see that because it was happening in a compressed period and in a relatively small place. So, you know, things can change really quickly.
Let's go back to the phones. Charlie, thanks, by the way. Rachel is with us in Utah. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you. Well, you have kind of touched on my question, actually. I was going to say I come from a very religious background in which traditional gender roles are very much the norm and the expectation, but I've spent a lot of time in the Middle East lately where, like Korea, since there are patriarchal norms and all that, and I was actually wondering how you think America compares to the world in that regard and what you see changing in the future.
Anything to add? Hannah Rose?
Yes, let me, if I can address the religious elements for a moment, because there's a different way this takes place in the U.S. and elsewhere. So I found it very poignant, actually, in the town I visited in Alabama to watch people, especially the older generation, who'd been brought up very strongly with the notion that the man is the head of the household, not kind of in despair or ditching this lodestar of their lives completely, but just thinking about it, like, how can the man, head of the household has generally meant breadwinner,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
Is there some way we can preserve a man's role as head of the household without him being the breadwinner? And, you know, depending on the generation, the answer would be yes, maybe, not really. But, you know, but the yes was very moving, this idea that the man could be the spiritual head of the household and the ultimate protector without earning without earning most of the money,
yeah.
and which I think is a completely fair and wonderful compromise. In terms of the Middle East, when I first started talking about this book, I would just automatically say, you know, except the Middle East surely can't be going through this. I mean, if you look
yeah.
at the Middle East and how women are treated. But the Middle East actually, then people wrote me to correct me. And I will just mention a news story, which some of you may have heard, that a couple of weeks ago, sometime last month, Iran forbade women from taking certain majors. They banned women from certain college majors, yeah. several dozen majors. Now, why did Iran do that? Because in Iran, just as in the Middle East, women are extremely successful at school. And the only way they could think to stop that, you know, just to put a brake on the end of men, let's say, is to, you know, just say they can't have those majors, you know. But you see it's happening. I mean, even in the Middle East, people, the notes I got from Middle East experts, and I hesitate here because it's anecdotal and I haven't looked into it more carefully. But,
yeah.
you know, they said, like, look at the pictures of the Arab Spring. Like, why do you think so many women are out there on the streets? Because we have this new generation of extremely highly educated women, more educated than the men, and they've got nothing to do with this education. There are so many professions that are off limits to women. And so, you know, what can they do with this knowledge? They can march in the streets, you know, or they can do one of two, or, you know, they can be teachers. There's not that many options. So anyway, I haven't looked into the Middle East, but it's possible things are happening there as well.
Here's an email from Connor who writes, I was raised by a single mother and I feel like I'm more okay with sharing some more traditionally female roles with my wife. Is there any correlation, he writes, between men raised by single mothers and being more generous about this shift in roles?
So I love that question and I'm so glad he brought that up because single motherhood is increasingly becoming mainstream. We recently passed the mark where more than half of children born to women under 30 were born to single mothers. It is for sure a class divided phenomenon. So
right.
if you have a college degree, you're very unlikely to be a single mother, relatively unlikely. Whereas if you don't, you're increasingly likely to be a single mother. And, you know, of course, in an ideal world, one would have help raising one's children. I have three of them, so I know how hard it is. But I think we are going to, as a nation, have to start looking at single motherhood and family structures in a slightly more creative, less rigid, and less punitive way. Because there are going to be lots more people raised by single mothers. And so we have two choices here. We can, A, try and help this family unit that is not married, which in America we're reluctant to do. In lots of European countries, you know, a family unit is a family unit, whether they're married or not. But here we don't really think of it that way. So we can sort of send social services and support their way such that they, you know, we try to keep them together as long as possible.
Mm.
Or we can start looking at the benefits of single motherhood. You know, are there any benefits here? Is there something good to say about raising a mother? Because otherwise what you're getting is a really entrenched matriarchy where, you know, the benefits of the mother pass to the child and the sons are kind of alienated from that picture. So,
mm.
you know, if more men raised by single mothers ended up with the feeling that there was some benefit to having been raised by a woman only, I think that would be great.
Well, there's a good segue here to a chapter you write about single girls and sex. And you write that young women are more in control of their sexual destinies now than they probably ever have been. And you talk about going to Yale last year, and you wanted to, you know, sort of talk to these students about their romantic lives. Talk about this, because this was a really fascinating turn, I think, in the story, for me anyway.
Yeah. Yes, this was very confusing, because we hear so much about the hookup culture, and our, you know, immediate reaction is, okay, this must be terrible for women. Like, this new world in which people don't date, in which, you know, you have a lot of intimate connection without a lot of commitment, this must be horrible for women, and they must be victims in this culture. And I do think there's some truth to that. I mean, I think you rarely find a woman who says, you know, awesome, you know, the more one night stands, the better. Like, that's not what women are after, you know? So, But there were these researchers who camped out in a college dorm for 4 years. They were actually looking for sexual violence in relationships. And instead, what they found is something that surprised them, which is that women were avoiding long-term commitments, that this idea that women were seeking them and men were avoiding them was not quite right. Mm. That, in fact, at that age, because there are so many women going through college, focused on their careers, wanting to establish themselves, it was actually quite dangerous to them to get tied down too solidly and too quickly before they had figured out what they wanted to do them for themselves and where they wanted to land. And I think this was a revelation. It exists simultaneously with a lot of women's complaints. Nonetheless, it is a very big part of the story. So I've since gotten letters from a lot of young women explaining it to me even better. And basically saying, like, look, Hannah, we're not choosing between one-night stands and marriage. That's not where we're at. We are creating this third form of a relationship, which is something like friendship, sexual intimacy, you know, emotional sustenance. Mm. It's just not marriage yet. Like, we're just not interested in getting married yet. But we have – when I read these letters, basically, you know, I don't feel horrified for the future of my children in the way that I do sometimes when I read just about the hookup culture.
What, so, like, that it's not Girls Gone Wild? It's something
It's not Girls Gone Wild. It's something else. Like, I got a ton of emails about this describing, you know, really in detail. Like, okay, this is what it looks like. People sent me Craigslist ads by women who were sort of defining what it is they wanted from men, women in their 20s. And I read these, and as a parent, I did not feel like, oh, if my daughter or son were in such a situation, I wouldn't be able to sleep at night. Seemed all right. I mean, it's not what I was doing when I was in college, but it seemed fine. It seemed lovely in some ways.
Hannah Rosin is with us. Her book is called The End of Men and the Rise of Women, and we need to take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Hannah Rosin. We're talking about her book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Let's go back to the phones. Michael is with us in Salt Lake. Michael, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Oh, that's okay. Thank you for taking my call, Doug. And I think it's a really great show, in particular because your guest, from what little I've heard, has been talking about the rise of women. But I've read some articles by, I think it's a psychologist named Michael Gurian, who's talked about the end of men and how boys are not raised like they used to be raised. They don't have good role models, they don't have good mentors, and they don't have the organizational, like the Boy Scouts and other teams and things that used to treat men how to be good men. And I'm wondering if your commentator has any input as to that.
Hannah Rosin?
I do. I have a chapter on education, and it's pretty clear that boys are struggling in school in many ways, especially in the younger ages, and there are many guesses as to why that's happening. Michael Gurian, the author who the caller mentions, you know, does talk about character education, and I think that's become something that we all talk about lately. There's a few books that address that on the bestseller lists these days. And, you know, there are other people who think it's because schools have become too feminized or, you know, because boys have too many distractions. I think there's great debate in the educational community about why exactly it is that we have come to think of schools as not the natural, you know, as sort of not a happy home for boys, as working against the natural inclinations of boys.
You've said that all of this research that you've done writing the book has caused you to start raising your two sons differently. Talk about that.
Yes, it is clear to me. I have two school-age kids, say a son and a daughter. One of them's too young to enter the picture. But it's clear to me that what school is demanding comes more easily to my daughter than it does to my son. They're both equally smart, and they're both really good students. It's just that it's much more of a struggle for him than it is for her. So I've had to think really hard about this. You know, I'm not a believer in changing the essential nature of my son. Like, I will never, you know, as I said, he's the budding computer programmer. Mm. Like, you know, William wants a doll. I think those experiments are generally failures, right? And as a parent, I'm not a big believer in sort of telling the school they have to treat my son in a special way. Like, I know there are movements out there that try and do soft things like, you know, change the nature of what kids read or let them run around, and that's all perfectly fine. But that's different to me than, like, demanding the institution bend to meet the needs of my son. My children go to public school. And so the third way is basically to just give him tools. Like, I think a lot about when a woman said to me, you know, school is so complicated these days, we have had to become our son's secretaries. I was sort of horrified by that. Like, I don't want to be my son's secretary because I'm not going to be with him his whole life. I don't want his wife to have to be his secretary. So I've tried to give him an internal secretary, like basically give him a list of things that he has to do every day. You know, very simple things that help his organization, like pack up your stuff, you know, don't forget your lunch, put your homework here. And like, and just allow him to try and internalize these skills that are going to serve him well, knowing full well that he's not going to internalize them as easily or as naturally as my daughter does. Mm-hmm. But just try and give him some of the tools he might need for this economy.
Back to the phones. Let's see. Christopher is with us in Ogden, Utah. Christopher, welcome.
I'm career military, and I've been listening and very intrigued by the conversation. I wanted to know what your guest's research on military service for females has concluded.
Is there any spin? You don't really write about that in the book. Is there any spin on military culture in here?
Yes. I mean, the only spin I would say about women and military culture is I think the loosening up of, you know, the opening up of roles for women in the military does have to do, both affects and is informed by our changing notions of women and aggression and what they're capable of. I mean, we went through something like this with the firefighter Supreme Court cases where, you know, we conceived of firefighting as entirely about strength. And so, you know, the question was, you know, could women pass these same strength tests? And when they could pass those same strength tests, you know, then it became about something more conceptual and essential. Like, is there something about being a firefighter which on its face excludes women, you know? Yeah. And ultimately, we as a nation decided, no, there isn't. You know, there's still vastly more male firefighters. But I think the military is going through something like that, especially in the new ways of fighting. You know, people are thinking, is there something essential about being a fighter that, you know, on its face excludes women? And I think, you know, we're deciding we're not sure about that at this point.
You know, you come back around in the book you're quite optimistic. You say in your heart that you believe men will learn to, as you put it in the book, decode this new flexibility. So you do feel that men can, we have it in us, I guess. We can figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, if you think, I often think about the period after World War II where men, you know, the GI Bill was passed, men were coming back from war, so they felt like the underdogs. I mean, they felt marginalized all of a sudden in a society that they had once controlled. They were pushed into doing all kinds of things, going to school, going to office, you know, entering office life, taking over farms. You know, that was a period of kind of extreme flexibility pushed by, you know, the post-war urgency of reestablishing yourself, in which I think men behaved a lot like the women that I'm describing today. So yes, I do feel hopeful about that. I mean, I don't see any reason why, if we've been so open-minded about women's roles, we couldn't be equally open-minded about men's roles. I might be missing something. It doesn't seem to me instinctively true that, you know, we've changed so much on one front. Like, why couldn't we change so much on another front? Like, how long before we pass the guy at the park on Tuesday at 3 p.m. with his children and we don't have the thought, what's wrong with that guy? Is he out of work? You know, like, how long will it take us to not have that thought anymore?
Do you talk about the fact that it's not in some ways there's still a gender gap and things aren't perfectly equal in some ways. But I guess the question I wondered about was, do you think that men are going to, once they do decode all of this, make a move to regain the upper hand?
That's an excellent question. I mean, one hopes that what you have is a kind of convergence, you know, that you have people picking and choosing from traditionally masculine, feminine traits based on their, you know, inclination, temperament, you know. So if you get a woman like Marissa Mayer, who just had her baby and decided she didn't want to take any maternity leave and, as the head of Yahoo, you know, then that role can exist. It's not going to be common, but that she could do that if she wanted to. Or, you know, you have like a Katniss Everdeen who from The Hunger Games, who's the traditional male warrior. And, you know, she ends up marrying, you know, she ends up with Peeta, who's a very feminine. He has so many feminine traits. You know, he's the nurturer. He's the baker. He's the one who, you know, knows how to charm a crowd. And he's the romantic. And so, you know, you feel like people can start to pick and choose depending on their personalities, their desires, what they want from themselves and for their families a little more easily. So a man in this town in Alabama in the next generation can become a teacher or a nurse if he's so inclined. And if not, he can move elsewhere and work in an aeronautics plant, you know, with a couple of years of schooling or something.
Less than a minute. Do women also have to adjust?
Yes, I think women do have to adjust. I mean, we haven't talked much about wage gap and continuing inequalities and how to get over them. But in my book, I do have a chapter about that in which I address the kind of penalties women pay for standing up for themselves, behaving in ways we consider too aggressive. I mean, this is why we don't have a lot of women in politics or as CEOs. And then I think, but ultimately the workplace has to adjust too, because we do have just about the least family-friendly workplace in all of industrialized society. So, you know, that's the real sort of policy shift that needs to happen.
Hannah Rosen, she's the senior editor, by the way, at The Atlantic and the author of the book The End of Men and the Rise of Women. She joined us today from the offices of Slate in Washington, D.C. Hannah Rosen, thanks very much.
This was so delightful. Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Taylor Almond. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.